Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua and the Vatican's art treasures. Join us on a tour inside St. Peter's Basilica to find out all the famous and not so famous ways in which the artists and sculptures Michelangelo and Bernini left their mark on this basilica. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus raised his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come. Give glory to your Son, that your Son may give glory to you, inasmuch as you have given him authority over all mankind, that he may bestow eternal life on those you gave him. Eternal life is this, to know you, the only true God, and him whom you have sent, Jesus Christ. I have given you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do. Do you now, Father, give me glory at your side, a glory I had with you before the world began? I have made your name known to those who gave me out of the world. These men you gave me were yours. They have kept your word. Now they realize that all you gave me comes from you. I entrusted to them the message you entrusted to me, and they received it. They have known that in truth I came from you. They have believed it was you who sent me. For these I pray, not for the world, but for these you have given me, for they are really yours. Just as all that belong to me is yours, so all that belongs to you is mine. It is in them that I have been glorified. I am in the world no more, but these are in the world, as I come to you.
In all 3 years of the liturgical cycle, the Gospel for the last Sunday before Pentecost is taken from the prayer with which our Lord ended the Last Supper, the prayer known as the High Priestly Prayer of Jesus, a title apparently given it by the 5th century doctor of the Church, St. Cyril of Alexandria. Today's Gospel presents the first part of this prayer with its dramatic opening words, Father, the hour has come. The mind goes back instinctively to that moment at the marriage feast in Cana, when Mary had said to Jesus, They have no wine, and he answered, My hour has not yet come. Writes a scholar, quoting St. John's account of the miracle Jesus performs on that occasion.
The miracle he performs manifested his glory. That of the signs, as John likes to define the miracles, is a partial glory, a dawning which pre-announces the fullness of day, barely sketched out by the first light. When the hour comes, the glory will shine in all its splendour.
Only a few days before his passion and death, Jesus speaks of his hour, which he knows to be imminent. Philip and Andrew tell Jesus there are some Greeks who have come up to Jerusalem for the Passover and want to meet him. But Jesus seems not to have heard, for he answers, Now the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And he speaks of the grain of wheat that must die if it is to bear fruit. The hour of glorification, scholars tell us, is the hour of Jesus' death. And though he knows this, his humanity is fragile, and he admits, perhaps talking more to himself than to the apostles.
Now my soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But it was for this very reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. A voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again.
The moment of weakness has passed. Fear, writes our scholar, is overcome in the lucid consciousness of his mission. Of all the many times the evangelists write of Jesus praying, this is the only time they, John in this case, record what he says, which suggests that he certainly prayed aloud, that he wanted them all to hear. On that fateful night, what must have been the feelings of the men gathered round him, his chosen ones, his friends, when he spoke those ominous words, "The hour has come"? And what powerful emotions must have stirred the heart of the old man writing his gospel in Patmos and remembering that night so long ago and far away? John knew now only too well what "the hour" meant, and what the Master had meant by those words which must have seemed so strange at the time. "Give glory to your Son, that your Son may give glory to you. I have given you glory on earth. Do you now, Father, give me glory at your side, a glory I had with you before the world began?" And referring to the apostles, "It is in them that I have been glorified." What was it, this glory, and what did it mean to be glorified? A 16th century definition of glorification explains it as the action of glorifying or the condition of being glorified, especially the exaltation of Christ to the glory of heaven. In a modern dictionary, the first meaning of glorify is to praise and worship God, followed by to reveal the glory of God through one's actions. And a similar meaning is found in a 1933 dictionary, to advance the glory of God or his name by faithful action or suffering. And didn't Jesus claim just that when he said, "I have given you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do"? And there's an interesting comment in a dispatch of 17th of May 1587 sent to Sir Francis Walsingham, one of the chief secretaries of state of Queen Elizabeth I.
"There must be a beginning of any great matter, but the continuing unto the end, until it be thoroughly finished, yields the true glory."
The writer of this dispatch was Sir Francis Drake, the navigator who was to play a leading role the following year in the dispatch of the Spanish Armada. Another definition of glorify in the same old dictionary is to extol, honour, magnify with praise, which brings us surely to Our Lady's Magnificat. And Gerard Manley Hopkins, in his poem The May Magnificat, wonders why May is dedicated to Mary.
"Why fasten that upon her, with a feast in her honour? Is it only its being brighter than the most or must delight her? Ask of her, the mighty mother. Her reply puts this other question: what is spring? Growth in everything. All things rising, all things sizing, Mary sees, sympathizing with that world of good, nature's motherhood. Their magnifying of each its kind with delight calls to mind how she did in her stored magnify the Lord."
And glory? Old and new dictionaries seem to agree that it is praise, worship and thanksgiving offered to God, or worshipful praise, honour and thanksgiving, as in the phrase "giving glory to God," while the version of the Middle Ages was praise, honour and thanksgiving offered in adoration. For the Israelites, the glory of God was contained in the Ark of the Covenant, for there God was present. So when the ark was captured by the Philistines, a newborn babe was named by his mother Ichabod, because she said, "The glory is departed from Israel." Ichabod is Hebrew for "Where is the glory?" Many are those who seek to win earthly glory, defined variously as high renown or honour won by notable achievements, honourable fame, praise, distinction, admiration granted by common consent. But as St. Peter wrote, quoting Isaiah, "All flesh is as grass, and its glory like the wild flowers." "And oh, how quickly the world's glory passes away," exclaimed Thomas à Kempis in his Imitation of Christ. A sentiment which is voiced during the coronation of a pope, when flax is burned to represent the transitoriness of earthly glory. The paths of glory lead but to the grave, commented Thomas Gray in his Elegy in a Country Churchyard. And in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, the poet laments.
Indeed, the idols I have loved so long have done my credit in this world much wrong, have drowned my glory in a shallow cup, and sold my reputation for a song.
But for the poets of the Romantic movement, glory was not a pursuit of fame, but something precious belonging to childhood and youth, wrote Byron.
Oh, talk not to me of a name great in story. The days of our youth are the days of our glory.
And was Keats thinking that way when he wrote in the dedication of his poems, Glory and Loveliness Have Passed Away? Most eloquent on the theme was Wordsworth, who mentions this glory numerous times in his ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood.
There was a time when meadow, grove and stream, the earth and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now as it has been of yore. Turn wheresoever I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen, I now can see no more. The rainbow comes and goes, and lovely is the rose. The moon doth with delight look round her when the heavens are bare. Waters on a starry night are beautiful and fair. The sunshine is a glorious birth, and yet I know, wherever I go, that there hath passed away a glory from the earth. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream?
And yet, despite all, the poet declares,
those first affections, those shadowy recollections, are yet the fountain light of all our day. Uphold us, cherish, and have power to make our noisy years seem moments in the being of the eternal silence.
Wordsworth believed in the immortal soul, and as one critic writes, while wondering why the glory had fled, he believed that man must learn through his suffering heart and his thinking mind another way into the abiding world of the spirit.
Though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, we will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. In the soothing thoughts that spring out of human suffering, in the faith that looks through death, in years that bring the philosophic mind. Thanks to the human heart by which we live, thanks to its tenderness, its joys and fears, to me the meanest flower that blows can give thoughts that do often lie too deep for tears.
And so there, as Humpty Dumpty said to Alice in a totally different context, there's glory for you.
I don't know what you mean by glory, Alice said. Humpty Dumpty smiled contemptuously. Of course you don't, till I tell you. I meant there's a nice knock-down argument for you. But glory doesn't mean a nice knock-down argument, Alice objected. When I use a word, Humpty Dumpty said in a rather scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less.
But from the ridiculous we must return to the sublime, to the only true glory, the glory Jesus speaks of in his prayer, the glory of God. Perhaps it's best summed up in this phrase, quoted in the old Shorter Oxford Dictionary.
The honour of God, considered as the final cause of creation and as the highest moral aim of intelligent creatures.
As for how to achieve that aim, St. Paul puts it simply.
Whatever you eat, whatever you drink, whatever you do at all, do it for the glory of God.
And for St. Paul, glory is our true destiny.
we are children of God. If we are children, we are heirs as well, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ, sharing his sufferings so as to share his glory. I think that what we suffer in this life can never be compared to the glory, as yet unrevealed, which is waiting for us.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. Born in 1475, Michelangelo was a towering figure of the Italian Renaissance period, whose genius as a sculptor, painter and architect helped to create so many of the artistic marvels that we see today in the Vatican. Whilst his frescoes on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel are arguably his best-known work, Michelangelo made a huge contribution to how we experience St. Peter's Basilica today, with his famous sculpture, the Pietà, and also his design of the church's breathtaking dome. Another Italian artist and sculptor who also left a major mark on the Vatican Basilica was Gian Lorenzo Bernini, a master of the Baroque in the 17th century. To find out some fresh details about Michelangelo and Bernini's works in connection with the Basilica, I paid a visit to St. Peter's in the company of Liz Lev, an art historian who lectures on Renaissance art at several universities here in Rome. She told me that the long and turbulent history connected to the building of this gigantic basilica tells us how ambitious that project was.
Everybody from the beginning of church building was vying for the biggest church spot, and St. Peter's Basilica was the largest church in the world when it was completed in 1626. There was nothing to match it. Today, St. John the Divine in New York City is actually longer, and then there was a replica made in the Ivory Coast, which is made 1 meter bigger. So we do have churches that are wider, they're taller, they're longer, but nothing is quite like St. Peter's.
Absolutely not. It took 120 years, didn't it, to complete? And how many popes were involved?
I think it's 20 popes, 12 architects, 120 years, and the Protestant Reformation. So if something could go wrong, it went wrong with this project.
On entering the Basilica, we turned our attention, first of all, to Michelangelo's sculpture known as the Pietà, which is on display on the right, close to the main doors into the church. Carved from a single block of white marble when the artist was only 23, this masterpiece depicts the Blessed Virgin Mary holding the lifeless body of her crucified son on her lap. I began by asking Lev to explain why Michelangelo's Pietà was so groundbreaking at that time.
Well, it was not sculpted for the place it's in today. It was sculpted for the old church, so it was in a small round room. You should have been 10 feet from the Pietà, and now you're a huge distance with a giant piece of bulletproof glass. Michelangelo was given a single block of marble, a basically year time limit, and the most interesting problem he had was the subject matter, because no Italian had ever sculpted the subject matter of the Pietà before. It's not even in the Bible. And so Michelangelo looked at what the Germans and the French, the inventors of the subject matter of the Pietà, did. And they looked at these bodies of Jesus with all of the wounds and the crown of thorns, all so people would feel pietà, or pity. And then he decided to do something different. He was from Florence, and anyone who's been to Florence knows that Florentines don't do ugly. And so Michelangelo decided to give us a Pietà in the form of a triangle where Jesus would be so beautiful that our pity would not be awakened by the suffering and the wounds, but it would be awakened by the loss of that beauty.
And it's also very naturalistic, isn't it? It's not just the Renaissance ideal of beauty, but there's a strong dose of naturalism.
The genius of the work is the blending of the two. On one hand, it's obvious that the body of Jesus comes from studying ancient sculptures, the articulation, the proportions. Jesus is perfect. But he also looked at a dead body in those unforgettable moments where the shoulder is up under the ear, the fold of flesh falls over the fingers, the muscles slump in the thigh. That's where you get that poignancy of a beautiful body, but that no longer is alive.
Is it true that it's the only bit of sculpture that was ever signed by Michelangelo?
Yes, it turns out that Michelangelo, after producing a work that was so groundbreaking and so new for the Jubilee year of 1500, was in there as the pilgrims piled in from all over the world and looked at what a beautiful sculpture is and said, "Who did it?" And he heard someone say, "Oh, I know the guy. He's Christopher Solari from Milan." But not Michelangelo's not from Milan, not called Christopher Solari. And so he very famously came in, signed his name on the sash which crosses Mary's chest, and as they say, it's the only work he ever signed.
Michelangelo, that's not the only piece of work by a long chalk that he's done here in the Vatican. Let's look at the dome, the cupola of St. Peter. This was what he labored on in the last years of his life, didn't he? He didn't even get paid for it.
It's an amazing bracketing of Michelangelo's career. It opens in this image of Mary and Jesus of the Pietà, and it ends with Michelangelo, 70 years old, taking on a job he had been passed over and over again in 1545 when they asked him to complete the dome of St. Peter's Basilica, which will go over the tomb of the Apostle. He spent 19 years on that project. He died 3 weeks shy of his 90th birthday, and he did it for no money. He did it for, and I quote, "the glory of God, the honor of St. Peter, and the salvation of my own soul."
And he did a major redesign, didn't he, of Bramante's original design.
All plans for this church always involved a dome derived from the Pantheon, in which the dome would have sat very, very close to the body of the church. Even Bramante's plan still kept the dome, although there were little windows close to the body of the church. The problem is the Pantheon, albeit a perfect building, is a perfect pagan building. Everything about the Pantheon celebrates how men become gods. So Michelangelo spent 19 years recalculating the stress of the dome so he could put in these 16 massive windows. Look up above in that dome, and those windows, a man comes up a pane and a half. They let in nothing but light. They support no weight, and you forget that's 137 and a half foot span of brick and masonry above your head. It's only 5 feet smaller than the Pantheon. It's only 6 feet smaller than the famous Dome of Florence, and yet Michelangelo's dome looks like it's floating.
And it still dominates Rome's skyline even today.
As a matter of fact, the design of Michelangelo Dib not only has called for the very tall dome, but the rounding of the sides. When you look to the left and the right, you see the sides curve out. And in his design, before they altered it in 1601, the form of the church was the head and shoulders of the church. It dominated the skyline because after the Reformation, there are the head and shoulders reappearing on the world landscape. Every church that was built after in its wake all had domes. St. Ignatius, the Church of St. Philip Neri, they all pop up like little heads standing around the leader, a beautiful and very distinct skyline.
At the Vatican, Bernini is probably most famed for his design of the colonnade encircling St. Peter's Square. But inside the basilica, he also created a number of masterpieces, especially his massive canopy made out of cast bronze and positioned over the tomb of St. Peter, the first pope. Lislev tells us more about Bernini's canopy.
Well, like Michelangelo, Bernini will be working his entire life from 25 to when he dies at 82 in the environment of St. Peter's. His major works are accomplished here. 25 years old, his first job was essentially to do something to make Peter's grave more noticeable. Michelangelo's plan of the Greek cross had been altered in 1601 after Michelangelo's death, and now you have a church which is 187 meters long. You walk in the front door, you can't see the dome. How are you supposed to understand where Peter's tomb is? So Bernini built a 95-foot tall, 175,000-pound canopy in bronze, unmistakable from the front door. Incredibly difficult project, and yet there it is, immediate beacon to the presence of St. Peter and over the Pope's own altar.
Is it true that the bronze that Bernini used for the canopy was taken from the Pantheon?
It's actually a complicated story. The pasquinade, that which the barbarians didn't do, the Barberini did to poke fun at the Barberini Pope, who took indeed the bronze off the Pantheon, which is believed to have been used for this canopy. Believe it or not, it was actually used for something that I think most listeners will find more scandalous. They were used for new cannons for the Castel Sant'Angelo. However, remember that Pope Urban VIII Barberini was the pope for the 100th anniversary of the Great Sack of Rome on May 6 of 1527, in which tens of thousands of Romans died because the city was not prepared. During the time of the pontificate of Urban VIII Barberini, there was the 30 Years' War going on all over Europe. Rome was really the only oasis of safety, but with no standing army and no protection. So in a certain sense, this was a maneuver in order to try to protect the citizens, but as often citizens do, they found it more of an occasion to poke fun at the Pope.
But I gather the twisting columns didn't meet with everybody's approval, did they?
Well, you can imagine, after all of that work, building a three-story building in bronze inside another building, to unveil that and have people say, well, why would you use those twisting columns? A lot of people critiqued him for an architectural order that wasn't part of the Greco-Roman milieu. But what they weren't thinking is that the original columns 1,700 years ago that framed Peter's tomb, that were given by Constantine, the man who legalized Christianity, were identical to those bronze ones. They were smaller. They were made of marble. They couldn't be used in the new church because the new church is so vast. But Bernini was simply hearkening back to the same imagery pilgrims saw all those years ago and using the same imagery for the pilgrims of today. So the continuity of the church and also the exoticness, because Peter came from the East. He didn't come from Greece or Rome. He came from the East, and his message was exotic, just like the columns.
Let's turn now to the chair or throne of St. Peter, which is one of the precious relics inside the basilica. I mean, this was claimed to have actually been used by the apostle, but that's somewhat unlikely, I presume.
Well, to begin with, the chair, the big bronze throne, is a reliquary. And inside is an ancient wooden chair which was used in papal coronations for many, many years. It apparently was fixed up by Charlemagne, so we mean means it was there in 800. And it was always considered to be Peter's particular chair when he was Bishop of Rome. And then it was incorporated into a larger monument.
But has anybody ever done any dating work on it?
The chair, the ivory additions into the chair date from the time of Constantine. And insofar as the wood itself, I don't remember ever seeing anything about the exact dating of the wood.
So that's lost in the mist of times, you might say.
The chair was incorporated into that monument in 1657, so no one's been able to get at it since then.
Tell us something about the significance of this feast day of the Chair of St. Peter.
Well, the feast day of the Chair of St. Peter celebrates Peter's authority. And of course, it's a reminder of the magisterium, because the idea of Peter's chair isn't a king's throne, it's the cathedra, it's the teaching chair, and it's a reminder of Peter's entrusted with the deposit of the faith, a deposit that has been handed down from pontificate to pontificate to pontificate. So it alludes very specifically to the role the Pope has as teacher, following in the footsteps of Peter, also teacher.
And thanks there to Liz Lev, an art historian who teaches at several universities in Rome, for filling us in on just some of the most prominent treasures to be found inside St. Peter's Basilica. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us here on Vatican Radio. And don't forget, you can listen to our programmes at any time by checking out our website on en.radiovaticana.va. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.